Hello, I'm Alma Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the proud mother of four children, one of whom has Prader-Willi syndrome.
And I am Iris Miller. I'm a certified rehabilitation counselor and the proud mother of two children, one of whom has quadriplegic cerebral palsy and is nonverbal.
In this podcast, we discuss the uncensored truth about raising children with disabilities.
Prepare to laugh, cry, and hopefully learn something new.
This is Two Moms, No Fluff. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Moms, No Fluff, the place where we discuss all things related to raising children with disabilities. I'm Alma Schneider, and I'm here with my podcast partner, Iris Miller, and very good friend, and we're very happy to see you here.
Yes, Alma, thank you for the introduction. I'm very excited and happy to have a very special guest here, someone who I truly look up to and am so proud to have as a part of our local activism and advocacy community here in Michigan. And I want to introduce Jen Lapman, who's been truly an activist and an advocate for more than 39 years in this space of disability rights. Jen, I am so happy that you cleared your busy schedule to join us today. And in favor of our listeners, if you don't mind introducing yourself.
Sure, thank you. I'm Jen Lapman, and I'm losing my voice. Sorry to say that. I have lived in Michigan pretty much my whole life. I am the sister to Mary, who joined our family after having lived in a state institution for her childhood. And then as she was, as we were starting to close institutions in Michigan, her biological family had, you know, her mom had passed away, and there were some circumstances that caused her to join our family, and she's my sister. And she's 71 and living her best life. I also am mother of, there are actually four boys that call me mom. Three of them are actually my children, and one, I was his guardian when he was a child. And so it wasn't an adoption, but a guardianship. And so I'm still his mom as well. And the three younger boys who were all, had been foster children and then came to either be my adopted child or the guardianship, all receive behavioral health services of some sort. So I have a son with a brain injury because he was in a car accident when he was 8. I have a son who has autism. And then my youngest son has significant trauma related disabilities because of things that happened to him before he came to my family. So my passion about making sure that people with developmental disabilities have good lives comes from more than just my professional experiences. It comes from, you know, having family members that I love deeply. And so in terms of my professional work, I have been in almost every position you can think of. I've been a direct support professional working with folks coming out of institutions. I've been a support coordinator for people using self-directed services. I have been an advocate for in the education realm, in the adult services world. I've actually helped people with like personal representation and guardianship and alternatives to guardianship. And lately, the thing that I spend most of my time on, I still spend a lot of time on individual advocacy, but I spend a lot of my time now on more public policy advocacy.
Okay. Wow. Well, that's a lot. And I'm very impressed. So it sounds like, you know, this is a part of who you are and your constitution, because you were doing this before you started working, I'm assuming. And I'm wondering what the impetus was, because you were dealing with this on a personal level, what was the impetus to start working with four people with disabilities?
Oh, gosh. So, okay. My father was a farmer. I grew up on a farm. Mm-hmm. And in farming, you often need lots of help, right? At certain times of the year or whatever. And so a lot of the farmers would hire people to help at harvest time or planting time or whatever. And one of the things that happened with our family is that anybody who came to my dad for a job, looking for help, looking for work, my dad would hire them no matter what. And so we had people with all different kinds of disabilities that worked for us over the years, people who had just gotten out of prison, Anybody that wanted to work, my dad said, if you want to work, you can come and work for me. And so we always, as kids, were surrounded by all different kinds of people from all different places, right? And so that certainly helped me to feel like that's where I felt comfortable. That was my space, right? Mm-hmm. And then when I was in sixth grade, my father realized, this was in the 70s, and farming was really hard in Michigan in the 70s. And so he said, you know, if I continue this path, I'm not going to be able to send my kids to college. And so we started selling off farmland, and he took a job at a place called Pinecrest here in Midland County in Michigan. And it was what they called a county infirmary. It was, in the olden days, they would have called it the county poor farm. It was essentially a small institution, kind of looked like a nursing home, mm-hmm. For people who, pre-Medicaid days, right? In the pre-Medicaid days, it was people that were indigent, people who had disabilities or who were aging and needed care, but they didn't have any way to pay for it.
Okay.
And then when Medicaid came into the picture, that in Midland County, that infirmary continued to operate. And it was really filled with people who didn't have people. It was filled with people with developmental disabilities or mental illness or senior citizens that needed care that didn't have sons, daughters, nieces, nephews, sisters, brothers, right? And so we moved there. We were on site farm managers. And so we moved there and lived there with the folks. And I just can remember.
Sorry, excuse me.
Oh, go ahead. Were you going to say something? Oh, I would just remember being struck by the loneliness that people felt, even though they lived in this big place, mm-hmm. and the lack of connection to anybody outside of this place. So it was the 70s, and Dad would say, I got to go to the feed store. Who wants to come? And like 10 guys would raise their hand. And so my brother and I, who were in sixth and fourth grade, would hop in the back of the pickup truck, because back then you could do that with
no 10 guys,
right? With 10 guys from the infirmary, and we'd go into town to the feed store. And for them, that was like the biggest deal. And so kind of that's when I said, you know, I would really like to figure out how to work with people so that they can have more opportunity to have good lives. So that's kind of where it came from.
Wow.
That's an amazing story. I love hearing it, even though it's my second time. It just goes to show that you don't have to be born into a family of politicians and grow up in Washington, D.C., to really make a change on a grand scale. And I love your personal story. I also now, kind of listening to your personal perspective on maybe disability rights in the US in a way, can you also give our audience a bit of a run through on the hardcore kind of changes that brought the disability rights movement to where it is almost today?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously it's people with disabilities have been struggling to find their place, right, for as long as time has started. In the United States, of course, just as the civil rights movement was really causing people to think differently in the 1960s, people with disabilities started really standing up also kind of in that same era, right, 1960s, 70s. There's a really great, lots of really great documentaries and books and stuff about the beginning of the civil rights movement, but really thinking about people with disabilities and how to best support them, really, I think the place it started was as a civil rights movement, right? So, you know, Judy Heumann, whose mother fought for her to be able to go to public school. And then she had to fight to be able to, you know, she's a licensed school teacher. She had to fight to be able to actually get a job in a school, right? Those were civil rights issues. But it helped us understand what kinds of supports people with disabilities need so that they can exercise their civil rights, so that they can be a contributing part of the community, right? And so I think that, you know, those are the people, Ed Roberts, Judy Heumann, those are the people that I look to as the pioneers and the people who really started that movement for folks with disabilities to have the support they need to have the life that they desire.
Yes, and I love what you were saying. It's important to remember always that disability rights are human rights, and that it's also another quote that I know that you usually love to add is that there's nothing about us without us. I feel that in your work and our work, these are also influential figures. We just, Alma and I had another meeting, and of course we were talking about Judy Heumann, and it just, I think she would always be kind of the mother of the disability rights movement in the United States, and has a special place in all disability related conversations. So thank you for mentioning her.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned some of the work that you do in Michigan. If you could talk a little bit about how the work that you've done in Michigan relates to other states' work, that would be helpful.
Sure. So you know, I think there are a couple of areas where that are really big. There were some growth in Michigan that then started spreading around the country. And one of those is in the area of what person-centered thinking, person-centered planning really means, right? Another, what I consider to be a giant in the disability community is Judith Snow. And if you don't know who she is, please Google her and then read every word she has ever written.
Okay.
She comes from Canada, and she was born with very significant disabilities. Like, she could move her finger or something. She completely dependent on others for all of her ability to, you know, be a part of her, to live. And and she really she and her circle of people that loved her and cared about her sort of created those first circles of support and sort of coined the term person-centered planning, and really helped drive the change in Michigan from a system where, when I started my career, it was all the professionals that told the person with the disability what all your bad things you can't do, all the things you need help with, right? And then here's what we're going to give you. Here's what you're going to do. And Judith sort of tipped that on its side here in Michigan and helped us to think about, well, wait a minute, what if we ask people whose life it is what they would like their life to look like and what they think they need so that they could live that good life, right? And so that was the beginning of person-centered planning in Michigan. It became a part of our law in 1996. It's in our mental health code that the way that you figure out what supports and services you're going to get from our systems is through this process, right? And so I think that person-centered planning and that notion that the person whose life it is the one who is the expert and knows what they want to do with their life and also what they need. I think that's something that's very important. That's like a nationwide, you know, movement and much needed. And the other area that I think is really important, that I think Michigan started out really strong and we're lagging, is in the area of self-determination and self-directed services. Okay. Again, it's, you know, who's driving the bus, right? It needs to be the person and their family and their freely chosen allies, not funders or systems or those. The funders and the systems need to be on the bus, but they shouldn't be driving the bus. And so I think that if I think about what two advocacy areas really impact real people's lives on the day-to-day basis, those would be the two things.
Jen, do you mind maybe in favor of parents to younger children who are listening to this podcast, maybe kind of breaking it down a little bit, those concepts of self-determination, self-directed services, so people can have a bit of a better understanding, maybe by an example, if you can.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, obviously we both know of some examples, right? But I can talk about, there was a call I took 6 minutes before I hopped on this podcast from a family, right? That their child has some significant mental health concerns. And so they in Michigan have Medicaid through what's called SED, severe emotional disturbance waiver, right? So they've got this Medicaid waiver and they're getting these services from the system. And they recognize that, well, they've realized that they need to be able to be really picky about who their providers are, who's coming into their house to help them with their son, right? They've tried, you know, they tried using some sort of, you know, provider agencies and things like that, and it just wasn't working. And so with self-directed services, or with, in the case of a child, family-directed services, right? That family is able to take a budget that has been allocated for their child and then hire people directly that they can train, that they can be the supervisor and the manager, And so it makes it a little bit more comfortable when someone's coming into your home, especially like in the case of this family I'm working with right now, they've got staff in their home pretty much 24/7. So you really, you know, you don't want to have it be like some random person coming and going, right? You want to have a little bit more of the control.
Right.
The other thing about self-direction for families is that sometimes, you know, it's easier to, as a family, if you're going to use like, say, recreation therapy or speech or physical therapy, like you might have a therapist that works out in the community that you really like, as opposed to the one that's employed by, you know, the community mental health or, you know, the funding source, right? Mm-hmm. With self-directed services, a family can say, oh, you know, this is the physical therapist we'd like to use. Let's enter into an agreement with them so that the Medicaid dollars can go to a qualified provider, even if that qualified provider isn't contracting with the CMH or the, you know, the funding source. So I think for families, self-directed services, there's a little more work to it, right? Because you're now all of a sudden you're a boss of people.
Yep.
So there is more work to it, but there's also, I think, more ability to, to feel safe and comfortable with the team that you're surrounding yourself with, right? And to be able to direct that a little bit more.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you reminded me of the transition programs that are in Montclair, New Jersey, where I am, where people don't realize, and we're always trying to share the information, that you don't have to do the prescribed program that your high school is, you know, the high school is, it's their legal obligation to provide transition services. And historically, that was daily life skill, living skills, and you're going to work at this job and you're going to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. Now there's a lot more because of creative thinkers and people who really think out of the box who are working for those transition programs, at least here in Montclair. There's a real effort to talk to each individual student and say, even before 21, so we're talking 18 to 21, what kind of job would you like? Not just we're sticking you in a pizza place. We're, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to work with the public as a greeter? Do you want, you know, all sorts of options. And it's really important, just awareness out there, that we let people know that it doesn't have to be, you know, told to you what you're going to do. You can make some choices now. And that's, it's like we're incrementally moving just a tiny bit forward with all of these things, allowing people to have self-determination, you know, in all areas of life, even before, you know, 21. So boy, thanks for the wonderful work you're doing. I'm wondering how you feel parents could be better advocates, because clearly you are quite adept at this and it's come from your personal and professional life at this point. What about the average parent who has a child with a disability and wants to become a better advocate? Any suggestions, recommendations?
I do have some suggestions and recommendations. And first of all, you know, education and knowledge is power, right? So the more you can learn about the resources that are available to you, the better. That's really hard to do though. You know, I think about my youngest, you know, for the first 6 months that he was here, I didn't have a second. He needed so much of my time. I did not have a second to try to research anything, right? But what I did do is I had the ability to scroll on social media after he went to bed for about 10 minutes, right? And so, you know, sometimes finding those other parents, and I think social media is a really great place to do that. But even there might be local parent groups in your community that meet in person. I know here in Midland, we have a beautiful support group that meets in person, plus a really great, robust social media presence. Because
I'm assuming you're referring to Iris's group.
I am, because of Iris. Yeah, it's Iris's.
Which is only an imitation of Alma's group in Montclair, which is bigger and better.
But those are, you know, lots of communities. Like in Michigan, there are those parent groups that are meeting, and it's really that's organic sort of grassroots. But if you can figure out how to connect yourself, you know, to an organization or to a group of parents like that, there are also advocacy organizations that you could reach out to, right, that can stand side by side with you. One of the things I do in terms of individual advocacy is that when parents are struggling with school systems, right, we have in Michigan a very robust system. It's called the Michigan Alliance for Families, where a parent can get an advocate that then walks side by side with them, teaching them things that they need to know to advocate for their child, helping to do that advocacy when needed. So I say, take that little bit of time after the child, the 10 minutes that you have in a day, and try to find those connections, right? Find those other moms and dads, find those organizations that maybe have some support groups or you know, things like that you can connect to. And then you, a lot of the learning I did in 39 years of doing it professionally, but you know, a lot of what I know was just from experiencing it, right?
Right.
And so once you feel like you've got some support and you can begin to then really sort of pay attention and open your ears and hear what's going on in all of these meetings instead of being flooded and overwhelmed, right? Then I think that you're going to be in a really great position to start advocating for your child. And I do something that, you know, I just because I'm nerdy this way, I like figure out, okay, so my kid has a HAB waiver. So now I'm going to find where all the HAB waiver information is in
What's a HAB waiver?
A habilitation waiver. It's just a type of Medicaid waiver, right? So my kid has this. So I am going to, he doesn't really, but I'm saying if he did, I'm going to learn everything I can about the HAB waiver. So my sister does have that waiver. And so as soon as that happened, as soon as she got that, I started reading everything I could about what that offers and what that means, right? So I didn't like try to learn everything about the whole system. I just tried to learn about the part of it that my sister was accessing, right? And that's a way to start too, so that it doesn't feel so overwhelming.
That's very good. That's a really good suggestion, because I think so many parents just feel so overwhelmed that they honestly don't even know where to start. And it just seems so overwhelming and daunting. But just to have, just to address the need, a specific need, and find out about that can really break it down and, you know, allow us to take it in.
Yes, I actually, Jen, everything that you spoke about reminded me of other episodes that we recorded, with this conversation about that shattered dream of your family and your child's future, and how would it look like now that you received a diagnosis that is sometimes very devastating. And I think there is something about the person-centered planning and the self-determination that brings back the power to the family. Even if the child is very young, it gives an opportunity to the parents to reevaluate kind of maybe what is the priority for them as parents, for that child and for their family. And maybe just a personal take, you know, when my husband and I did that process and said, these are the things that we enjoy, these are the things that give us the sense of quality of life, one of them was traveling. And now my daughter is older and can voice her opinion, and she's saying loud and clear, I am not interested. Thank you. Stop dragging me around the world. I had enough. So then you need to reevaluate now that she can voice her opinion and, have really person-centered planning is really around her. But until that point, it gave us a lot of, I guess, optimism around the situation. We redefined our priorities and then we looked for solutions. How do we do that despite or in light of the disability? And I love it that in a way here in Michigan, because of people like you and because of really, thank you, Jen, for all of your personal work, we have the possibility of really exploring life with a disability from that point of view. And after saying that, I want to ask you another question, if you don't mind. And that is, what is your view, or how do you see the future of disability services? Where should we head towards in the future?
Oh my gosh. So I think I'm going to start answering that question by talking about something that is a crisis across the country, which is the issue of being able to find reliable, qualified direct support, right? So of my four family members that need behavioral health services, one of them pretty much needs someone all of the time. She's got cerebral palsy. She has spastic quadriplegia. You know, she left alone for long periods of time, she would not thrive, right? And finding direct support professionals is kind of a crisis point, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I think about the future, I think, okay, so we've created this system, and it's pretty similar across all states in the country, right? That of how we fund these services. And that system of how we fund these services is sort of poverty-based, right? You have to be poor to access it. And it's often a capitated sort of managed care sort of system where there's X number of dollars that has to go for everybody, right? And so sometimes mm-hmm. it feels like there's shortages, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the big picture is thinking about what is that going to look like in the future? Because right now, with the direct support professional situation, for people who need that particular service, right, who need that particular type of support, this feels non-sustainable, right? And I'm not mm-hmm. trying to be scary, because I have hope. I have hope because I've seen lots of changes over the years of how our system operates, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that as advocates and activists, we need to be trying to think about and imagine a different way that part of the system, right, can be funded, managed, organized, so that we can keep the promise that person-centered planning offers, which is that every citizen can take their rightful place, right? So that's the big, yeah.
Sorry, I was going to say, and that those direct support service providers and workers can get paid a living wage, because it seems as though, at least in New Jersey, that is not the case. And, you know, it our family members, our loved ones need people who are trained and able to do the job that they were hired for. And unfortunately, there aren't the trainings, there isn't the experience, and there's so much transition with new workers, and it's so disruptive to the individual's life as well as their family's life, trying to get new people all the time because it's not working out. So it's really a very short-sighted system right now. So I agree with you. This is what I keep hearing is my son, who's 19, gets older and older. What I keep hearing from people a little ahead of us is, oh, we can find the group housing. We can find all of these and we can find the workers, but they're not supporting our kids the way that they need to. So that's a very scary thought for me that's looming going forward. So are you recommending that be an area that people who have younger children and older children, I guess, and family members really focus on going forward in terms of policy change and activism?
Yes, I do feel like that's a very important area. Again, for people with the most significant amount of need for support, right? People that lie for their, I mean, there's a gentleman that I work with down in Flint that he has a respirator. If he were to be left alone, even for a little bit in that, and it malfunctioned, he's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, this is life and death. Reliable people with him 24 hours a day. Yeah. And so the idea, you know, so for many people, it's a life or death proposition. And my sister probably wouldn't die. She'd call me up and I'd go over there, and then we'd both be a couple of grumpy old ladies, you know, trying to battle through. But neither of us would be living our best life, I'll tell you that. Yeah. So I mean, so it's huge. It's people will not thrive, right? If we can't shore up that very foundational support structure for people with developmental disabilities.
Right. Thank you. This is very useful information.
Yes. Jen, so maybe the last question is, if you have any words of advice to the parents who are not yet advocating, not for their own child, and definitely not on a national level, how does one start with the advocacy and activism? And if you can maybe tell us a little bit of how to make the personal political and vice versa.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, again, connecting with other family, other parents, other people that, you know, that are passionate about this civil rights movement is a good start. And it can be really simple. You can really start out very simply. So, for example, in Michigan right now, we have a coalition of organizations and people that are trying to convince our legislature to infuse more money into the system for direct support professionals. You know what? Sign on a letter that says you agree with that position. It's that simple. Sometimes there's like what they call one-click politics, where you literally can just click and it sends the letter out to your legislator. You don't have to look up who it is. So that's a start, right? Or if your legislators are having coffee hours, go have coffee. Tell them your story. Just tell them your story. I mean, really, the best, the the way that things change, the really only way that things change is when a person with their gifts and strengths and talents brings together other people who are passionate about their vision, and then it spreads and spreads and spreads, right? So Iris's personal story to Bill Schutte, our representative, is so impactful. She has done so much activism just by telling her story. So tell your story to the people that are out there every day making the policy, right? That's my advice, I think.
And that's great advice, because it's everybody can relate to that. And, you know, as we always say, most of us are going to be disabled at some point in our lives. So this isn't, you know, those people, this is going to be all of us. And we need it. You know, we really need it. We can't wait till the last second and then freak out because there's nothing available for us. This has been really, really helpful. Thank you so much. Is there anything that you'd like to add that we haven't touched on that you feel is important, Jan?
I don't know. I think you did a great job of asking your questions. I think that this was really fun, and I hope that people, get something out of it that they can use, some little nugget of support.
Great. I'm sure they will. All right. How about you, Iris? Anything, any last words?
No, I just wanted to thank you, Jan, again, for all your work and for really paving the path for so many other individuals and families, and for still 39 years into it, continuing on strongly on a national national platform and beyond. And I really appreciate all that you do for the disability community. And thank you for your time today. And thank you for anyone and everyone who was listening today, for our old audience that has been with us from the beginning. And there were people who joined us today for the first time. If you have any questions for Jan or for Alma or myself, please contact us at info@2momsnofluff. Thank you very much and see you next time.
For more information, please go to www.2momsnofluff.com. Thank you.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe and give it a 5-star rating so more people can hear it. Thank you.